falling. How do you think Elias has caused all this? Do you not see that there is a black, fell winter coming down on you, out of all season, beyond all your power of understanding?
Iskrimnor stood again, round face pale, eyes squinting.
What then, man, what? Are you saying, Wooden One, I help me, that we are fighting the white foxes out of old legends?
Behind him was a chorus of whispered questions and shocked mumblings. Yarnauga stared at the Duke, and his seamed face softened with an expression that might have been pity or sorrow.
Ah, Duke Iskrimnor, bad as the white foxes, who some know as the Norns, bad as they would be. It would be a boon to us if it were the whole case. But I tell you that the Tuku, the queen of the Norns herself, mistress of the dreadful mountain Storm Speak, is no more the guiding hand than is Elias.
Hold, man, just hold your tongue a moment.
De Vercellis leaped up angrily, robes billowing.
Prince Joshua, forgive me, but it is bad enough this madman walks in and disrupts the council, stealing away the floor with no explanation of who or what he is. But now, as emissary for Duke Leobardis, I must waste my time listening to northern bogey tales? This is insufferable.
As the hubbub of argument rose again, Simon felt a strange, exciting chill. To think that he and Binnebik had been in the center of it all, in the middle of a tale that would boggle anything Shem Horsegroom could devise. But as he thought of the story he might tell beside the fire one day, he remembered the muzzles of the Norn hounds and the pale faces in the dark mountain of his dreams. And again, not for the first time or the last, wished desperately that he was back in the Hayhold kitchen, that nothing had changed, that nothing would ever change. Old Bishop Anodis, who had been watching the new arrival with the keen, fierce gaze of a gull confronting a newcomer to his favorite scavenging ground, arose.
I must say, and I feel no shame in admitting it, that I have thought very little of this raid. Elias has perhaps made mistakes, but His Holiness the Lector Anessin has offered to mediate, to try and find a way to bring peace between Aedonites, including, of course, their honorable pagan allies.
He nodded perfunctorily in the direction of Gwythyn and his men.
But all I have heard is talk of war, and the spilling of Aedonite blood in revenge for petty insults.
Petty insults? Iskrimnor fumed. You call the theft of my duchy a petty insult, Bishop? Let you come home to find your church a damned hirka stable or a nest of trolls, and see if you find it a petty insult.
Nest of trolls, said Binnebik, rising.
And this only proves my point,
Anodis snapped, wielding the tree in his knotted hands as though it were a knife to hold off bandits.
See, you shout at a churchman when he seeks to correct your foolish ways.
He drew himself up.
And now,
he waved the tree at Yarnauga,
now this bearded hermit comes to tell tales of witches and demons, and drive a wedge larger still between the only sons of the High King? Who does that benefit, eh? Who does this Yarnauga serve, eh?
Red and shaking, the bishop collapsed into his chair, taking the flagon of water his acolyte brought and drinking thirstily. Simon reached up and pulled on Benedict's arm until his friend sat down.
I am still wanting an explanation for Nest of Trolls, he growled under his breath.
But at Simon's frown, he pursed his lips and was silent. Prince Joshua sat staring for some time at Yarnauga, who bore the prince's eye as calmly as a cat.
I have heard of the League of the Scroll,
Joshua said at last. It was not my understanding that its adherents tried to influence the ways of rulers and states.
I have not heard of this so-called league,
Devaselli said, and I think it is time this strange old man told us who sends him, and what it is that endangers us, if it is not the High King, as many here seem to think it is.
For once I agree with the Naban man, Quithin of Hernestia called out. Let Yarnauga tell us all that we may decide whether to believe him, or drive him from the hall.
In the highest chair, Prince Joshua nodded. The old Rimmer's men looked around at the expectant features, then raised his hands in a strange gesture, touching fingers to thumbs, as though to hold a slender thread before his eyes.
Good, he said. Good. Thus we are on the first steps of the road, the only road that might possibly lead us out of the mountains, Black Shadow.
He spread his arms, as though drawing the invisible thread out to great length, then opened his hands wide.
The story of the League is only a small story, he began, but it fits inside a larger story.
Again he walked to the door, which a page had closed to keep the warmth in the high-raftered hall.
Yarnauga touched the heavy frame.
We can close this door, but that does not make the snow and hail go away. In the same manner, you can call me mad. That will not make he who menaces you go away, either. He has waited 5 centuries to take back what he feels is his. And his hand is colder and stronger than any of you can understand. His is the larger story, inside which the tale of the League is nestled like an old arrowhead stuck in a great tree, over which the bark has grown thick until the arrow itself is hidden. The winter that is upon us now, the winter that has dethroned summer from its rightful place, is his. It is the symbol of his power as he reaches out and begins to shape things to his will.
Yarnauga stared fiercely, and for a stretching moment there was no sound but the wind's lonely singing beyond the walls.
Who? Joshua asked at last. What is the name of this thing, old man? I thought you might know, Prince, Yarnauga replied. You are a man who has learned many things. Your enemy, our enemy, died 500 years ago. The place where his first life ended lies beneath the foundations of the castle where your life began. He is in Eloki, the Storm King.
Chapter 33. From the Ashes of Aswa.
Stories within stories, Yarnauga intoned, shucking off his wolfskin cloak.
The firelight revealed the twining snakes that banded the skin of his long arms, occasioning fresh whispers.
I cannot tell you the story of the League of the Scroll without you first understanding the fall of Aswa, the end of King Aelstan Fiskerna. He who constructed the League as a wall against darkness cannot be separated from the end of Inaluki, whose darkness is now upon us. Thus the stories are woven together, one strand upon the other. If you pull a single thread away, it is just that, a single thread. I defy any man to read a tapestry from a solitary strand.
As he spoke, Yarnauga ran slender fingers through his knotted beard, smoothing it and arranging its great length, as though it were a kind of tapestry itself and might lend some sense to his story.
Long before men came to Ostenhard, he said, the Sithi were here. There is no man or woman who knows when they came, but they did, traveling out of the east, out of the rising sun, until they settled at last in this land, in Urkinland, on the site where the Hayholt now stands.
They made the greatest work of hands, the castle Aswa. They delved deep into the earth, laying its foundations into the very bones of Austin Ard. Then built walls of ivory and pearl and opal, stretching up higher than the trees, on towers that stood against the sky like the masts of ships, towers from which all of Austin Ard could be seen, and from which the sharp-eyed city could watch the great ocean bounding the western shore. For countless years they lived alone in Austin Ard, building the fragile cities on the mountain slopes and in the deeps of the forest, delicate hill cities like icy flowers, and forest settlements like earthbound boats with many sails. But Aswa was the greatest, and the long-lived kings of the city ruled there. When men first came, it was as simple herders and fishermen, wandering over some long-vanished land bridge in the northern wastes, fleeing some fearful thing behind them in the west, perhaps, or merely looking for new grazing lands. The city paid them no more mind than they did the deer or the wild cattle, even when the swift generations multiplied, and man began to build himself stone cities and forge bronze tools and weapons, as long as they did not take what was the city's, and stayed on the lands the Earl King had allowed them, there was peace between the peoples. Even the empire of Naban in the south, glorious in its arts and its arms, that put all mortal men of Austin Ard beneath its long shadow, caused no concern to the city, or their king, Eonigato.
Here Yanaga looked about for something to drink, and as a page filled a flagon for him, the listeners exchanged looks and puzzled murmurs. "Dr. Morghenis told me about this," Simon whispered to Benabik. The troll smiled and nodded, but appeared distracted by thoughts of his own.
"There is no need, I'm sure," Yanaga resumed, his voice raised to recapture the attention of the muttering throng, "to speak about the changes that came with the first Rimmer's men. There will be old wounds enough that shall be opened without dwelling on what happened when they found their way across the water, out of the west. But what must be spoken of is the march of King Fingal down out of the north, and the fall of Aswa. 5 long centuries have covered much of the story with the debris of time and ignorance. But when Aelstan the Fisher King charted our league 200 years ago, it was to find and preserve such knowledge. Thus there are things I will now tell you that most of you have never heard. At the Battle of the Nok at Ach Samrath Plain and in the Utan Wash, at one place and another, Fingal and his armies triumphed and drew the noose tight around Aswa. The city lost their last human allies at the Summerfield. Ach Samrath, and with the Hernisteri routed, there were none among the city who could stand against Northern Iron.
"Routed by treachery," said Prince Gwythyn, red-faced and trembling. "Naught but treachery could drive Sinach from the field, the corruption of the Thrithings men stabbing the Hernisteri in the back in hopes of some crumbs from Fingal's bloody table."
"Gwythyn," Joshua barked, "you have heard, Yanaga, these are old wounds. There is not even a Thrithings man present. Would you leap across the table and strike Duke Iskrimnor, since he is a Rimmer's man?"
"Let him try," growled Einskaldir.
Gwythyn shook his head, abashed. "You are right, Joshua. Yanaga, my apologies." The old man nodded, and Luth's son turned to Iskrimnor. "And of course, good Duke, we are here the thickest of allies."
"No offense was taken, young sir," Iskrimnor smiled. But beside him, Einskaldir caught Gwythyn's eyes, and the two stared hard at each other.
So it was, Yanaga continued as if there had been no interruption, that in Aswa, even though its walls were bound with old and powerful magics, home and heart of the city race though it was, still, there was a sense that things were at their ending, that the upstart mortals would throw down the house of their elders, and that the city would pass from Austin Ard forever. Ionegato, the king, dressed himself all in mourning white, and with his queen Amarasu spent the long days of Fingal siege, which quickly became months, then years, for even cold steel could not throw down the work of the city overnight. Listening to melancholy music and the poetry of the city's brighter days in Austenard. From the outside, in the camps of the besieging northerners, Aswa still seemed a place of great power, wrapped tight in glamour and sorceries. But inside the gleaming husk, the heart was rotting away. There was one among the city, though, who wished it otherwise, and was not content to spend his last days keening over lost peace and ravaged innocence. He was a Unigato's son, and his name was Inaluki. Without saying a word, but not without a good deal of noise, Bishop Anodis was gathering his things together. He waved his hand for his young acolyte, who helped him to his feet. "Your pardon, Yanaga," Joshua said. "Bishop Anodis, why are you leaving us? As you can hear, there are dreadful things moving against us. We look for your wisdom and the strength of Mother Church to guide us." Anodis looked up crossly. "And I should sit here in the midst of a war council I never approved of, and listen to this? This wild man speaking the names of heathen demons? Look at you all, hanging on his words as though they were everyone from the Book of the Aedon.
Those of whom I speak were born long before your holy book, Bishop," said Yanaga mildly.
But there was a fierce combative tilt to his head.
"It is fantasy," Anodis grunted. "You think me a sour old man, but I tell you that such children's tales shall lead you into perdition. The greater sadness, though, is that you may drag all our land down with you."
He sketched the sign of the tree before him like a shield, then tottered out on the arm of the young priest.
"Fantasy or no, demons or Scythi," Joshua said, rising from his chair to survey the assembly. "This is my hall, and I have asked this man to tell us what he knows. There will be no further interruptions."
He cast his eye about the shadowed room, then sat down, satisfied.
"Well, you should attend now," Yanaga said, "for this is the meat of what I bring you. I speak of Inaluki, son of Ionegato, the Earl King. Inaluki, whose name means here is bright speech in the Scythi tongue, was the younger of the king's two sons. Together with his older brother Hakatri, he had fought the worm Hidohebi the Black, mother of the red worm Shurake, that Prester John slew, and mother as well of Igjajuk, the white dragon of the north."
"Your pardon, Yarnauga," one of Gwythin's companions stood. "This is strange to us, but perhaps not all unfamiliar. We Hanisteri know stories of a black dragon, the mother of all worms. But in them she was called Drachnehir."
Yarnauga nodded, as a master at a pupil.
"That was her name, among the first men in the west, long before Hearn built the Teg at Herne's Sodok. Thus, do bits and pieces of older truth survive in the stories children hear in their beds, or soldiers and hunters share around the campfire. But Hidohebi was her Scythi name, and she was more powerful than either of her children. In the killing of her, which itself became a long and famous story, Inaluki's brother Hakatri was horribly wounded,
burned by the worm's terrible fires. There was no cure for his injuries, or the unending pain in all of Austenard. But neither did he die. At last, the king had him put in a boat with his most trusted servant, and they passed away over the ocean toward the west, where the Scythi hoped there was a land beyond the setting sun, a place without pain, where Hakat tree might be whole again. Thus, in Aluki, despite the great deed of slaying Hido Hebi, became his father's heir under the shadow of Hakatri's fall. Blaming himself, perhaps he spent long years in the pursuit of knowledge that likely should have been barred to man and Scythi alike. At first he may have thought that he could make his brother well, bring him back from the uncharted west. But as with all such quests, soon the search became its own reason and reward. And in Aluki, he whose beauty had once been the silent music of the palace of Aswa became more and more a stranger to his people, a searcher in dark places. So it was that when the men of the north rose up, pillaging and slaying to encircle Aswa at last in a ring of poisonous iron, Inaluki was the one who set his mind to defeating the trap. In the deep caverns below Aswa, lit by cunning mirrors, grew the witchwood gardens, the place where the Scythi tended the trees whose strange wood they used, as the southern men used bronze, and as the northerners used iron. The witchwood trees, whose roots, some say, reached down into the very center of the earth, were tended by gardeners as sacred as priests. Every day they spoke the old spells and performed the unchanging rituals that made the witchwood thrive. As the king and his court in the palace above sank more and more into despair and forgetfulness. But Inaluki had not forgotten the gardens, nor had he forgotten the dark books he had read, and the shadowy paths he had walked in search of wisdom. In his chambers, when none of the others came anymore, he began a task that he thought would be the saving of Aswa and the Scythi. Somehow, causing himself great pain, he procured black iron, which he gave to the witchwood trees as a monk waters his vines. Many of the trees, no less sensitive than the Scythi themselves, sickened and died, but one survived. Inaluki wove this tree round with spells, with words older perhaps than the Scythi, and charms that reached down farther even than the witchwood's roots. The tree grew strong again, and this time poisonous iron ran through it like blood. The caretakers of the sacred garden, seeing their charges blighted, fled. They told Ieyunigato the king, and he was concerned, but seeing as he did the end of all things, would not stop his son. What use was witchwood now, with bright-eyed men all around and deadly iron in their hands? The growing of the tree sickened Inaluki, even as it did the gardens themselves. But his will was stronger than any illness. He persevered, until at last it was time to reap the sought-for harvest. He took his dreadful planting, the which were all shot through with baleful iron, and went up into the forges of Aswa. Haggard, sick to madness, yet full of grim resolve, he watched the master smiths of Aswa flee before him and did not care. By himself, he heated the forge fires hotter than they had ever been. Alone, he chanted the words of making, all the while wielding the hammer that shapes, which none but the high smith had ever held before. Alone, in the red-lit depths of the forge, he made a sword, a terrible gray sword, whose very substance seemed to breathe
dismay. Such hideous, unholy magics did Inaluki call up during his forging, that the very air of Aswa seemed to crackle with heat, and the walls swayed as though struck by giant fists. He took the new forged sword, then into his father's great hall, thinking to show his people the thing that would save them. Instead, so terrible was his aspect, and so distressing was the gray sword, shining with an almost unbearable light, that the city ran in horror from the hall, leaving only Inaluki and his father Yunegato.
In the deepening hush that surrounded Yanaoka's words, a quiet so profound that even the fire seemed to have stopped sputtering, as though it too held its breath, Simon felt the hairs on his neck and arms stand upright, and a strange dizziness creep through him.
A sword? A grey sword? I can see it so clearly. What does it mean? Why does the thought stick in my head?
He scratched hard at his scalp with both hands, as though in his pain he might shake the answer loose.
When the Earl King at last saw what his son had made, he must have felt his heart turn to ice in his chest. For the blade Inaluki held was no mere weapon, but a blasphemy against the earth that had yielded both iron and witchwood. It was a hole in the tapestry of creation, and life leaked away through it. "Such a thing should not be," he told his son. "Better that we should go into the forgetful void. Better that the mortals gnaw on our bones. Better even that we had never lived at all, than such a thing should ever be made, let alone used." But Inaluki was maddened with the power of the thing, and horribly tangled in the spells that created it. "It is the one weapon that will save us," he told his father. "Otherwise these creatures, these insects, will swarm over the face of the land, destroying as they go, obliterating beauty they cannot even see or comprehend. It is worth any price to prevent that." "No," said Yunegato, "no. Some prices are too great. Look at you. Even now it has worn your mind and heart away. I am your king as well as your sire, and I command you to destroy it before it devours you utterly." But to hear his father demand such a thing, the unmaking of what he had nearly died of forging, and only done, as he thought, to save his people from final darkness, drove Inaluki past all caring. In that moment, he lifted the sword and struck his father down, killing the king of the city. Never before had such a thing been done. And when Inaluki saw Yunegato lying before him, he wept and wept, not only for his father, but also for himself and his people. At last, he lifted the grey sword up before his eyes. "From sorrow have you come," he said, "and sorrow you have brought with you. Sorrow shall be your name." Thus he named the blade Jingizu, which is the word in Scythi tongue.
Sorrow. A sword named Sorrow.
Simon heard it in his mind as an echo, bouncing back and forth through his thoughts, until it seemed it would drown out Yanaga's words, the storm outside, everything.
Why did it sound so terribly familiar? Sorrow. Jingizu. Sorrow.
"But the story does not end there," the northerner said,
his voice gaining strength even as its spell flung a pall of unease over the listening company.
"Inaluki, more maddened than ever by what he had done, nevertheless took up his father's crown of white birch wood and proclaimed himself king. So stunned were his family and folk by the murder that they had no stomach to resist it. Some actually welcomed the change in secret. Five, in particular, who, like Inaluki, had been angered by the idea of passive surrender to the surrounding mortals. Inaluki, with sorrow in his hand, was a force unbridled. With his five servants, whom the terrified and superstitious northerners named the Red Hand for their number, and fire-colored cloaks, Inaluki took the battle outside the walls of Aswa for the first time in almost 3 years of siege. Only the sheer numbers, the iron-wielding thousands of Fingal's horde, prevented the night terror that Inaluki had become from breaking the siege. As it was, if the other Scythi had rallied behind them, it could be that Scythi kings would still walk the battlements of the Hayholt. But Inaluki's people had no will left to fight. Frightened by the new king, horrified by his murder of Unigato, they instead took advantage of the mayhem caused by Inaluki and his Red Hand to flee Aswa, led by Amorasu the queen and Shima Onari, son of Inaluki's dragon doomed brother Hakatri. They escaped into the dark but protective ways of Ardeorta forest, hiding from the blood-mad mortals and their own king. Thus it was that Inaluki found himself left with little more than his five warriors in the glittering skeleton of Aswa. Even his powerful magics had proved too little at the end to withstand the sheer numbers of Fingal's army. The northern shaman spoke their weirds, and the lost protective magics fell away from the age-old walls. With pitch and straw and torches, the Remesmen set the delicate buildings to burning. As the smoke and licking flames rose, the northerners routed out the lost of the city, those who had been too weak or timid to flee, or who had felt too much loyalty to their memorial home. In those fires, Fingal's Remesmen did terrible deeds. The remaining city had little strength left to resist. The world had come to an end. The cruel murders, the heartless tortures and ravishings of unresisting victims, the laughing destruction of a thousand exquisite and irreplaceable things. With all these, Fingal Red Hand's army put his crimson stamp on our history and left a stain that can never be removed. Doubtless those who had fled to the forest heard the screams and shuddered and wept to their ancestors for justice. In this last most fatal hour, Inaluki took his Red Hand and climbed to the summit of the tallest tower. He had decided, it seems clear, that what the city could no longer inhabit would never be the home of men. That day he spoke words more terrible than any he had spoken before, more baleful by far than even those which had helped bind the substance of sorrow. As his voice boomed out above the conflagration, Rimmer's men fell screaming in the courtyard, faces blackening and with blood running from their eyes and ears. The chanting rose to an intolerable pitch, and then became a vast scream of agony. A huge flash of light turned the sky white, followed a moment later by a darkness so complete that even Fingal, in his tent a mile away, thought he had been struck blind. But in some way Inaluki had failed. Aswa still stood and still burned, although not much of Fingal's army lay wailing and dying on the ground at the tower's base. In the tower top itself, strangely untouched by smoke or flame, the wind sifted six piles of gray ash, scattering them slowly across the floor.
Sorrow. Simon's head was whirling, and he had difficulty drawing breath. The torchlight seemed to be flickering wildly. The hillside. I heard the wagon wheels. They brought sorrow. I remember it was like the devil in a box. The heart of all sorrow.
So Inaluki died,
One of Fingal's lieutenants, as he breathed his last breath minutes later, swore that he had seen a great form billowing out of the tower, crimson as coals in a fire, writhing like smoke, grasping at the sky like a huge red hand.
No!
Simon shouted, leaping up. A hand reached up to restrain him, then another, but he shook them off as though they were cobwebs.
They brought the grey sword, the horrible sword. And then I saw him. I saw Inaluki. He was...
The room was wobbling back and forth, and staring faces, Isgrimnor, Binnebik, the old man Yarnalga, loomed up before him like fish leaping in a pond. He wanted to say more, to tell them all about the hillside and the white demons. But a black curtain was being pulled before his eyes, and something was roaring in his ears. Simon ran in dark places, and his only companions were words in the emptiness.
Mooncalf, come to us. There is a place here prepared for you. A boy, a mortal child. What did it see? What did it see? Freeze his eyes and carry him down into shade. Cover him with clinging, stinging frost.
A shape loomed before him. An antler-headed shadow massive as a hill. It wore a crown of pale stones, and its eyes were red fires. Red was its hand, too, and when it clutched and lifted him, the fingers burned like fiery brands. White faces flickered up all around, wavering in the darkness like candle flames.
The wheel is turning, mortal. Turning, turning. Who are you to stop it? A fly he is, a little fly.
The crimson fingers squeezed, and the fiery eyes glowed with dark and infinite humor. Simon screamed and screamed, but was answered only by pitiless laughter. He awoke from a strange swirl of chanting voices and clutching hands, to find his dream mirrored in the circle of faces that bent over him, pale in the torchlight as a fairy ring of mushrooms. Beyond the blurry faces, the walls seemed lined with points of glinting light, mounting up into the darkness above.
He's waking up,
a voice said, and suddenly the glimmering points came clear as rows of pots hanging on racks. He was lying on the floor of a pantry.
Doesn't look good, said a deep voice nervously. I'd best get him some more water.
I'm sure he'll be fine if you want to go back inside,
the first voice replied. And Simon felt himself squinting and goggling until the face that went with it was no longer a blur. It was Maria. No, it was Miriam Mell, kneeling beside him. He couldn't help noticing how the hem of her dress lay crumpled beneath her on the dirty stone floor. No, no, the other said, Duke Isgrimnor pulling nervously at his beard.
What happened?
Had he fallen and struck his head? He reached up to feel gingerly around, but the soreness was general and there was no lump.
Keeled over you did, boy, Isgrimnor grunted. Shouting about things you saw. I carried you out here, fair busted a gut doing it too.
And then stood there staring at you, lying on the floor, said Miriam Mell, her voice stern. It's a good thing I was coming in.
She looked up at the Rimmer's man.
You fight in battles, don't you? What do you do when somebody's wounded? Stare at them?
That's different, the Duke said defensively. Bandage them if they're bleeding. Carry them back on their shields if they're dead.
Well, that's clever, Miriam Mell snapped.
But Simon saw a secret smile tug at her lips.
And if they're not bleeding or dead, I suppose you just step over them? Never mind.
Isgrimnor closed his mouth and tugged at his beard. The princess continued to wipe Simon's forehead with her dampened handkerchief. He couldn't imagine what good it was doing, but for the moment he was content to just lie back and be tended to. He knew that soon enough he would have to explain himself to somebody.
I knew I recognized you, boy, Isgrimnor said at last. You were the lad at St. Hodoran's, am I right? And that troll, I thought I saw.
The pantry door opened wider.
Ah, Simon, I hope you are feeling more of yourself now.
Binnebik,
Simon said, straining to sit up. Miriamel gently but firmly leaned on his chest, forcing him back down.
I did see it, I did. That was what I couldn't remember. The hillside, and the fire, and...
I know, friend Simon. I was understanding many things when you stood up. Not all things, however. There is still much unexplained in this riddle.
They must think I'm a madman,
Simon groaned, pushing the princess' hand away, but nevertheless enjoying the moment of contact.
What was she thinking?
Now she was looking at him like a grown girl looked at a troublesome younger brother.
Damn girls and women both. No, Simon,
Binnebik said, crouching down beside Miriamel to look him over carefully.
I have been telling many stories. Our adventuring together, not least among them. Yarnauka has confirmed much that my master was hinting at. He also received one of Morgani's last messages. No, you are not that mad, although I think still many are doubting the real danger. Baron de Vaselis especially, I am thinking.
Iskrimnor scuffed a boot on the floor. If the lad's hail, I think I'd better go back in. Simon, was it? Yes, well, you and I will talk more.
The Duke maneuvered his considerable bulk out of the narrow pantry and clumped off down the hall.
And I will be going in too,
Miriamel said, briskly chasing the worst of the dust from her dress.
There are things that should not be decided before I have been heard, whatever my uncle thinks.
Simon wanted to thank her, but could think of nothing to say while lying on his back that would not make him feel more ridiculous than he presently did. By the time he decided to throw over his pride, the princess had gone in a swirl of silks.
And if you are recovered to sufficiency, Simon,
Binnebik said, extending a small, blunt hand,
then there are things we must hear in the council hall, for I am thinking Naglimund has never seen a raid quite the like of this one.
First of all, young one, Yanaga said, while I believe all that you have told us, you must know that it was not Inaluki you saw on that hillside.
The fires had burned down to dreaming coals, but not a soul had left the hall.
If you had seen the Storm King in the form he must now wear, it would have left you a blasted, mindless shell lying beside the anger stones. No, what you saw, beside the pale Norns and Elias and his liegemen, was one of the Red Hand. Even so, it seems miraculous to me that you came away from such a night vision whole in heart and mind.
But...
As he began to remember what the old man had been saying just before the wall of forgetfulness had crumbled, spilling the memories of that horrible night, stony night, the doctor had called it, Simon was again puzzled and confused.
But I thought you said Inaluki and his Red Hand were dead.
Dead, yes. Their earthly forms burnt away utterly in the last scorching moments. But something survived. There was someone or something that was able to recreate the sword, Sorrow. Somehow. And it did not need your experience to tell me. For this is indeed why the League of the Book was made. Inaluki and his Red Hand survived. As living dreams, or thoughts, perhaps. Shades held together only by hate and by the terrible runes of Inaluki's lost casting. But somehow, the darkness that was in Inaluki's mind at the very ending did not die. King Aelsten Fiskerna came 3 centuries later to the Hayholt, the castle that stood upon the bones of Aswa. Aelsten was wise, and the seeker after knowledge, and he found things in the ruins beneath the Hayholt that made him aware that Inaluki had not been completely unmade. He formed the League, of which I am a member, and we are dwindling fast now, with the loss of Morgainis and Uke Cook, so that old knowledge would not be lost.
Not only knowledge of the Sith's Dark Lord, but other things too. For those were evil times in the north of Austin Ard. Over the years it was discovered, or rather guessed that somehow Inaluki, or his spirit, or shade, or living will, had become manifest again among the only ones who might welcome him.
The Norns, Binnebik said, as if suddenly a bank of fog had been swept away before them.
The Norns, Yanagar agreed. I doubt that at first even the White Foxes knew what he had become. But soon his influence in Sturmaspik was doubtless too great for anyone to say him nay. His Red Hand, too, has come back with him, although in no form seen before on this earth. And we had thought that the Lucan worshipped by the Black Rimmer's men was only our own fire god from heathen days, said Iskrimnor, wondering. If I had known how far they had strayed from the path of light.
He brushed his fingers against the tree that hung upon his neck.
Osiris, he breathed softly.
Prince Joshua, who had been listening silently for a long while, leaned forward.
But why, if it is indeed this demon out of the past who is our truest enemy, does he not show himself? Why does he play at cat's paw with my brother Elias?
Now we are coming to the place where my long years of study atop Tangoldir cannot be helpful, Yanauge shrugged. I watched, and I listened, and I watched, for that was what I was there to do. But what goes on in the mind of such as the Storm King is more than I can guess at.
Ethelfirth of Tynset stood and cleared his throat. Joshua nodded for him to speak.
If all this is true, and my head is a-swimming with it all, I tell you, then maybe I can guess at the last.
He looked around as though expecting to be shouted down for his presumptuousness, but seeing in the faces around him only worry and confusion, he cleared his throat again and went on.
The Rimmer's man, he tilted his head toward old Yanauge, said that it was our own Aelstan Fiskerner who was first in noticing that this Storm King had come back. That was 300 years after Fingil took the Hayholt, or whatever was its name then. It's been nigh 200 years since. It sounds to me as though this demon, I suppose, has taken a long time to get strong again. Now, he continued, we all know, we men that have held land in the midst of greedy neighbors.
He snuck a sly look at Ordmayr, but the fat baron had gone quite pale some time before, and seemed insensible to innuendo.
That the best way to keep yourself safe, and purchase yourself time to grow strong, is to have your neighbors fight each other. Seems to me that's what's going on here. This Rimmersgard demon gives Elias a present, then gets him a-fighting with his barons and dukes and such.
Ethelfirth looked around, hitched his tunic, and sat down.
It's not a Rimmersgard demon, Einskaudir growled. We're shriven Aedonite men.
Joshua ignored the northerner's comment. There is truth to what you say, Lord Ethelfirth, but I think those who know Elias will agree that he also has designs of his own.
He didn't need any Sithi demon to steal my land, Iskrimnor said bitterly.
Nevertheless, Joshua continued, I find Yanauge and Binnebik of Yikanuk, and young Simon, who was Dr. Morgani's apprentice, all too uncomfortably trustworthy. I wish I could say I did not believe these tales. I am not sure yet what I believe, but neither can I discount them.
He turned to Yanagar again, who was prodding at the nearest fire with an iron poker.
If these dire warnings you bring are true, then tell me one thing. What does Inaluki want?
The old man stared into the fire, then poked it again vigorously.
As I said, Prince Joshua, my task was to be the League's eyes. Both Morgani's and young Binnebik's master knew more than I of what might lurk in the mind of the master of Stormspike.
He raised a hand as if to ward off more questions.
If I had to guess, it would be to say this. Think of the hatred that kept Inaluki alive in the void, that brought him back from the fires of his own death.
What Inaluki wants, then?
Joshua's voice fell heavily in the dark, breathing hall.
His revenge?
Yanaga only stared into the embers.
There is much to think on,
the master of Naglamund said, and no decisions to be lightly made. He stood up, tall and pale, slender face a mask before his hidden thoughts.
We shall return here tomorrow sunset,
he went out, with a grey-cloaked guard on either side. In the hall, men turned to look at each other, then rose, clustering in small, silent groups. Simon saw Miriam El, who had never had her chance to speak, go out between Einskaldir and the limping Ducas Grimnor.
Come, Simon, Binnebik said, tugging at his sleeve. I think I will be letting Kantaka run, now the rains have gentled some. Of such things, we must take advantage. At this point, I have still not been robbed of my liking for thinking as I walk, with wind in my face. And there is much that I should be thinking.
Binnebik,
Simon said at last, the shocking, wearying day sitting heavily upon him. Do you remember the dream I had? We all had, in Jaloi's house.
Stormspike. And that book?
Yes,
said the little man gravely.
That is one of the things I am worrying with. The words you saw, they catch at me. I am fearing there is a dreadfully important riddle in them.
Simon
struggled with his muddled memories.
Du Svaden Verd, it was?
Binnebik sighed.
The weird of the swords.
The hot air beat painfully on Priorati's hairless and unprotected face, but he would allow no discomfort to show on his features. As he strode across the foundry floor, robes flapping, he was gratified to see the workmen, themselves masked and heavily cloaked, stare and flinch at his passing. Buoyant in the pulsing forge light, he chuckled as he briefly fancied himself an archdemon striding the tiles of hell, petty underdevils scattering before him. A moment later the mood fell away, and he scowled. Something had happened to that little wretch of a wizard's boy, Priorates knew it. He had felt it as clearly as if someone had jabbed him with some sharp thing. There was some strange, tenuous bond still between them from Stoning Night. It bit at him and gnawed at his concentration. That night's business had been too important, too dangerous to bear any kind of interference. Now the boy was thinking of that night again, probably telling all he knew to Luth or Joshua or someone. Something serious needed to be done about that nasty, prying boy. He stopped before the great crucible and drew himself up, arms folded upon his chest. He stood that way for no little while, already angry, growing angrier at the wait. At last one of the foundry men hurried up and clumsily bent a thick-breeched knee before him.
How can we serve you, Master Priorates?
The man said, voice muffled by the damp cloth wrapped across his lower face. The priest stared silently long enough to change the man's partially revealed expression from discomfort to real fear.
Where is your overseer? He hissed.
There, father.
The man pointed to one of the dark openings in the foundry cavern wall.
One of the crank wheels be gone on the winch,
your eminence.
Which was gratuitous, since he was still officially no more than a priest, but the sound of it was not inharmonious.
Where?
Priorates asked. The man did not respond, and Priorates kicked him hard on his leather-clad shin.
Get him, then, he shrilled.
With a head-wagging bow, the man limped off, moving like a toddling child in the padded clothes. Priorates was aware of the beads of sweat forming on his brow, and of the furnace-spewed air that seemed to bake his lungs from the inside. But nevertheless, a brief grin stretched his spare features. He had felt worse things. God, or whoever, knew he had faced worse. At last the overseer came, huge and deliberate. His height, when he finally shambled to a halt, and stood looming over Priorates, was almost enough in itself to be regarded as an insult.
I suppose you know why I've come,
the priest said, black eyes glittering, mouth taut with displeasure.
About the engines,
the other replied, voice quiet but childishly petulant.
Yes, about the siege engines, Priority snapped. Take off that damned mask, Inch, so I can see you when I speak to you.
The overseer reached up a bristle-haired paw and peeled back the cloth. His ruined face, rippled with burn scars around the empty right eye socket, reinforced the priest's sensation that he stood in one of the anterooms of the great inferno.
The engines are not finished, Inch said stubbornly. Lost three men when the big one collapsed draws day last. Slow going. I know they're not finished. Get more men. Eden knows there are enough slagging about the hilt. We'll put some of the nobles to work. Let them get a few blisters on their fine hands. But the king wants them finished now. He's going into the field in 10 days. 10 days, damn you!
Inch's one eyebrow slowly rose, like a drawbridge.
Naglamond? He's going to Naglamond, isn't he?
There was a hungry light in his eye.
That's not for such as you to worry about, you scarred ape,
Priority said contemptuously.
Just have them finished. You know why you are given this loftier place. But we can take it back.
Priority could feel Inch's stare on him as he walked away. Could feel the man's stone-like presence in the smoky, flickering light. He wondered again whether it had been wise to let the brute live, and if not, whether he should rectify the error. The priest had reached one of the broad stairheads, with hallways leading left and right, and the next flight of steps ahead, when a dark figure abruptly slid from the shadows.
Priorities.
The priest, whose nerves were such that he might not have cried out if struck with an axe, nevertheless felt his heart quicken.
Your Majesty, he said evenly.